Chapter 12. Another Look Back and a Look Ahead. Doing better and feeling worse. This phrase from a 1970s symposium on healthcare is more apt than ever, and not only in medicine. We seem to worry more than our ancestors, surrounded though they were by exploding steamboat boilers, raging epidemics, crashing trains, panic crowds, and flaming theaters. Perhaps this is because the safer life imposes an ever-increasing burden of attention, not just in the dilemmas of medicine, but in the management of natural hazards, in the control of organisms, in the running of offices, and even in the playing of games. There are, not necessarily more severe, but more subtle and intractable problems to deal with. To investigate why disasters should lead to improvement, and improvement should paradoxically foster discontent, it might help to look at three areas of technology we have not considered before: timekeeping, navigation, and motorization. The automobile first presented an acute problem, collisions, but its success reduced that difficulty while adding to it another less easily soluble one, congestion. And the recent history of motoring also suggests a paradox of safety, that the better made and less dangerous motor vehicles become, the greater are the burdens on the operator. The prognosis for revenge effects is hopeful. We will probably keep them under control. By replacing brute force with finesse, concentration with variety, and heavy traditional materials with lighter ones, we are already starting to overcome the thinking and habits that led to many revenge effects. Technology, too, is evolving and responding. The one thing we will not be able to do is avoid the endless rituals of vigilance. In one example after another, revenge has turned out to be the flip side of intensity. The velocity of 20th century transportation and warfare produces trauma on an unprecedented scale, which in turn calls for equally intensive care. But the end result may be chronic brain damage that is beyond medical treatment. Intensive antibiotic therapy has removed the horror of some of the 19th century's most feared infections, yet it has also promoted the spread of even more virulent bacteria. Massive shielding of beaches from the energy of waves has deflected their intensity to other shores, or robbed these beaches of replenishing sand. Smoke jumpers have suppressed small forest fires, but have thereby helped build reservoirs of flammable materials in the understory for more intense ones. Towering smokestacks have propelled particulates at great velocity higher into the atmosphere than ever before, to the dismay of residents over an ever wider radius. Intensive chicken, pig, duck agriculture in China has rushed new influenza virus strains into production for distribution internationally by the increasingly dense and speedy world network of commercial aircraft. Accelerating processor speed has multiplied computer operations without necessarily reducing costs to programmers, system managers, and end users. Rigid molded ski boots have helped prevent ankle and tibia fractures at the cost of anterior cruciate ligament injuries. And what are so-called pests but intensified life forms? Most of these animals and plants are unusually robust, prolific, and adaptive. The animals are mobile, and the plants spread rapidly. Fire ants, Africanized bees, starlings, Melaleuca go about their business single-mindedly. Even the dreamy-looking eucalyptus is capable of burning intensely to propagate itself, taking entire neighborhoods with it. And when intensity is a genuine protection against catastrophe, it may fail to address and even complicates persistent low-level problems. We have learned the limits of intensiveness. What next? In the near time, intensification is still working. Human health and longevity have improved in most places and by most measures. As we have seen, people may feel sicker today because they are more likely to survive with some limitation or chronic illness, but they really are better off. It is hard to disagree with optimists like Leonard Sagan and Aaron Wildavsky when they point to the benefits of growth. Fortunately, every prediction of global famine and misery has failed so far. The second argument for optimism is humanity's success in digging deeper and looking harder for old resources and substituting new ones. In the crucible of technological change, shortages produce surpluses and crises yield alternatives. When the biologist Paul Ehrlich lost a bet with the economist Julian Simon on future prices of a bundle of commodities selected by Ehrlich, they dropped between 1980 and 1990, costing Ehrlich $576.06, the transaction seemed to bear out Simon's argument that inexhaustible human ingenuity would find a way around apparent shortages. Market forces appear to impose conservation and encourage discovery more efficiently than legislation generally can. We have seen how the feared hardwood shortage of the early 20th century never happened, much to the dismay of Jack London and other hopeful eucalyptus growers. Of course, this analysis has revenge effects of its own for market economics. If constraint helps make us so much more clever, why should the state not prod the infinitely creative human mind with more taxes and restrictions? Heavy taxes on fossil fuels should, by the same logic, do wonders for conservation and alternative energy sources. When it comes to interpreting the last 100 years, the optimists have the upper hand. The future is another matter. Optimists counter projections of global warming, rising sea levels, population growth, and soil depletion with scenarios of gradual adjustment and adaptation. If the crisis of life in the oceans is the problem, then fish farming is the answer. A true optimist sees a silver lining even in the destruction of rainforests and wilderness. There may be much less acreage, but more and more people will be able to travel and see it. In terms of this strange anthropocentric utilitarian calculus, there will actually be more available forest and wilderness. As for soil depletion, genetic engineering and new methods of cultivation will presumably let us cope. The world can probably support a population of 10 billion or more. In 1994, it stood at 5.6 billion. Optimists and pessimists disagree not so much on what is attainable, but on how long it will be attainable. What the first group welcomes as a successful adaptation, the second belittles as a stopgap. Optimists and pessimists curiously agree that crisis is good for us, but for different reasons. Pessimists welcome emergency as a violent cure for profligacy. Optimists welcome it as an injection of innovatory stimulus. The ambiguity of disaster. One reason for optimism is that disaster is paradoxically creative. It legitimizes and promotes changes in rules, changes that may be resisted as long as the levels of casualties remain acceptable prior to a disaster that leads to change. More important, disasters mobilize the kind of ingenuity that technological optimists believe exists in unlimited supply. Of course, new disasters may themselves be unintended consequences of prior solutions. It is uncertain whether, at least in developed countries, the incidence of new catastrophes is gradually declining or not. Should disasters be considered as waves that remain constant in amplitude, damped or amplified? The unanswerable question about technological revenge effects is whether we are really learning. Even tragedies like Chernobyl and Bhopal are ambiguous as forewarnings. Are they just the most recent in an ongoing series that will strike again in Western Europe and North America, where matters are far less secure than their leaders admit? Or will they spark environmental consciousness and vigilance in the former Soviet bloc and the developing world? It is too soon to say, but there is excellent evidence that great disasters do have long-term reverse revenge effects. The first great modern stimulus from disaster may have been the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588. The economic historian David Landis has speculated that this greatest setback in the history of Spain was what led its King Philip III to offer a perpetual pension of 6,000 ducats to the discoverer of the longitude when he ascended the throne 10 years later. Landis is not sure, however, what method would have kept these surviving ships from their fate on the rocks of Ireland and the Orkney Islands. In France, the Duc d'Orléans made a comparable offer. From Galileo to Newton, most of the giants of the scientific revolution of the late 16th and 17th centuries, with or without prizes in mind, joined the search. None of these thinkers produced a practical astronomical system, yet the shipwrecks and prizes did have other substantial benefits. The sociologist Robert K. Merton has suggested how many advances in mathematics, astronomy, mechanics, and magnetism could be traced to the vast losses that Spain and other maritime powers had suffered. It took a further disaster to complete the paradoxical work, the wreck of three ships from the fleet of Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel in 1707 on the Scilly Isles off the west coast of England, killing almost 2,000 sailors. The admiral reportedly struggled ashore, only to be murdered for his magnificent ring. Today we know that bad geography, charts and compasses, and poor navigation, complicated by fog and unpredictable currents, were mainly to blame. To contemporaries, though, the lesson was a new urgency in the search for a way to determine longitude at sea. Of course, a valid method would in turn make possible more accurate printed aids to navigation. The question of longitude was not immediately supported officially. Only 7 years later, in 1714, was an Act of Parliament passed offering up to £20,000, at least $1 million in today's purchasing power, for a method of determining longitude on an ocean-going vessel. Entrepreneurs and cranks had been at work on solutions ever since the wreck, proposing lines of ships somehow anchored in mid-ocean, telepathic goats and even dogs communicating through a sympathetic powder, said by its promoters to relay sensations from an animal on land to one at sea after having been sprinkled on both. But the prize, after more than another decade had passed, attracted the attention of the gifted clockmaker John Harrison, who built a chronometer that met the specifications of the act. The steps and the time it took him to refine his timepiece, along with the fact that he did not secure payment of his claims until 1773 when he was 80, are not the point here. What matters is that the magnitude of the Scilly Isles wreck eventually justified the great reward offered. The earlier prizes contributed indirectly to the Act of Parliament. It was Newton, who had long worked on the problem, whose recommendation was essential for the Act's passage. Only in hope of the new prize did Harrison and other leading craftsmen abandon their normal clientele for a largely speculative project that had frustrated the scientific elite of Europe for decades. The search for longitude may represent the first great public high-technology program. In its costs and benefits, it became one of the most successful. Anything like it would almost certainly have been long delayed in the absence of a spectacular new disaster. It took another 200 years for a single marine disaster to have an international impact comparable to that of the Scilly Isles wreck. This was the sinking of the Titanic, pride of the White Star Line, on April 14, 1912. The ship's tragic end was memorialized not only as an enormous loss of life and property, over 1,500 passengers and crew perished, including the captain, but also as a cautionary tale. Some of its perceived lessons were social, the image of the frivolous rich fiddling as the world was about to burn, or even escaping in lifeboats as the poor drowned in steerage. Even the failure of other ships to respond to its distress calls has been blamed on the priority given by radio operators to the social cables of their first-class passengers. But in the long run, the dangers of technological pride rather than class conflict seem to be the message of this disaster. Even more than the loss of the three English ships 2 centuries earlier, the sinking of the Titanic immediately became what risk analysts now call a signal event, one that reveals an ominous and previously underestimated kind of danger. The problem was not mainly in the operation of the ship's systems, useless though some of the lifeboat mechanisms turned out to be. Even though White Star officials never claimed the ship was actually unsinkable, the captain and crew acted with inappropriate confidence, steaming at high speed through waters notorious for sea ice. After the Titanic hit the iceberg, the same confidence in the ship's safeguards delayed, with tragic consequences, the implementation of rescue procedures that could have reduced casualties immeasurably. Her officers doubtless had faith in the owner's stringent design specifications, but marine archaeologists now believe that the vessel's steel plates did not meet these standards. Belief in the safety of the ship became the greatest single hazard to the survival of its passengers, greater than the icebergs themselves. In fact, crews of other nearby vessels that might have rescued passengers believed the Titanic's distress flares could only mean some celebration, not an emergency. Less known is how important the Titanic disaster was in solving what had been a serious problem for international navigation, the prevalence of sea ice in the ocean lanes of the world's most active and lucrative route, the North Atlantic. The wreck had precedence. In the 1880s, over 50 passenger ships reported sea ice damage in and around the Grand Banks off the Newfoundland coast where the Titanic later went down. 14 of them had sunk. It was the loss of the Titanic that led not only to new regulations requiring lifeboat space for all passengers and crew, but to a series of international conferences on the Safety of Life at Sea, SOLAS, beginning in 1913. The International Ice Patrol, established in 1913, now uses aerial surveillance, satellite images, and radio-equipped oceanographic drifter buoys. The biggest bergs even have their own radio transmitters. Ships possess advanced radar systems. It would require extraordinary negligence for a captain to let an iceberg sink a ship. At least for passengers embarking in the United States, an ocean cruise now appears extraordinarily safe. From 1970 to 1989, only 2 of over 30 million passengers died in accidents involving cruise ships operating out of the United States, despite a number of collisions and fires. Each generation of ships meets higher standards. SOLAS now specifies a maximum 30-minute evacuation time for cruise ships. Only one ship has ever sunk after hitting an iceberg since the Titanic, and that was in 1943 when the ice patrol was discontinued during the Second World War. Both tragedies and their consequences illustrate the engineer and historian Henry Petrosky's point that a great disaster is often the best stimulus for new engineering ideas. Two things have changed, though, since the early 18th century. The growth of engineering as a profession has made a new type of error possible, as Petrosky has also shown, overconfidence in the safety of a new design, the defects of which too often remain hidden until some new disaster occurs. But there is also a second type of error. Failure to observe the repeated rituals that safe operation of advanced technology entails. The higher potential speed of steamships required, and requires, more rather than less care. The larger number of passengers and crew required, and requires, more careful drills and inspection of equipment. It is still difficult for a prospective passenger to tell how well trained a crew may be to handle an emergency. We know some technology has a built-in demand for care, a maintenance compulsion. But there is always a hidden catch of technological improvement, the need for enhanced vigilance that we have already seen in medicine, in environmental modification, in the translocation of plants and animals, in electronic systems, and even in some aspects of athletics. At this point in the history of technology, we can draw a fundamental lesson from an unexpected source, the law of negligence. In a number of important articles, the legal scholar Mark Grady correlates better and safer technology with the number of lawsuits for malpractice and personal injury. During the centuries when bleeding, purging, and mercury compounds, as we have seen, hastened the deaths of many of the West's elite, legal action against the physicians who pursued these remedies was rare. The public did not hold doctors in awe, neither did they really expect heroic remedies to work. In fact, it was precisely because they doubted the scientific basis of contemporary treatments that a malpractice suit had little point. According to Grady, quote, "The first negligence explosion occurred during the 1875 to 1905 period. In that time of industrial revolution, claims increased by fully 800%, and the negligence rule did not change significantly. When machines abound, negligence claims increase. Put differently, a doctor who forgot to perform a modern fetal health procedure could not have been liable in 1960 before the procedure was invented," unquote. On this view, a dialysis machine reduces the risk of kidney failure in nature, but adds a new risk, that physicians and technicians operating the machines under their supervision may fail to make safe connections, test the hemodialytic solution, or observe all the other precautions of good practice. Anyone who has watched the pilot and co-pilot of a common two-engine commuter aircraft carry out their extensive pre-flight procedures, flipping through pages in a printed notebook as they read their scripts, has been struck by the number of precautions that a long-accepted and well-developed technology imposes. By the standards of its day, the Titanic was a ship relatively high in what Grady calls durable precautions, the safety hardware that popular opinion supposed made it unsinkable. It is true that size, luxury, and speed had higher priority than safety in her design, but she had the latest in communications and damage containment equipment. Grady's analysis suggests, though, that the very presence of these measures increased the importance of non-durable precautions, all the things an officer or crew member must remember to do in keeping the ship afloat. The flow of messages on the ship's radio demanded constant attention. Did a given message warrant immediate transmission to the bridge? Once the captain was aware of it, did it necessitate a change of speed or course? And with lifeboats come other questions. Have they been inspected regularly? Does each crew member know his or her part in supervising a possible abandonment? If a major marine loss occurs, it is the way an emergency plan is carried out, not physical safeguards alone, that will determine whether or not it becomes a disaster for human life. Here is where the difference between early and industrial technology becomes telling. The captain of a 17th-century ocean-going ship needed excellent navigation skills, and the management of cargo, ballast, and rigging were already arts for specialists. Some captains and pilots of Renaissance and early modern Europe had superb intuition which let them achieve amazing feats of dead reckoning, the estimation of position from relatively crude measurements of last position, direction, and speed. A gifted mariner could go beyond the limits of the technology of the day. Yet because of the difficulty of measuring longitude, compounded by the other defects of instruments, disasters could happen to the best of seafarers. That is why Sir Cloudesley Shovel still got an overbearing tomb by Grinling Gibbons in Westminster Abbey after his catastrophic end. On the other hand, Joseph Addison ridiculed it as, quote, the figure of a beau dressed in a long periwig and reposing himself upon velvet cushions under a canopy of state, unquote, and deplored that it commemorated only his demise and not his victories. The better and the safer technology becomes, the more we presume human error when something goes seriously wrong. If it is not the error of the captain or crew, it is one of the engineers or designers of equipment, or of executives and their maintenance policies. The automobile and revenge effects. Intensity, disaster, precaution, vigilance. The cycle appears on land as well as at sea. The rise of motoring shows this more clearly than the transformation of sailing, but in a different way. As we saw in Chapter 1, 19th-century railroad accidents were the first of a new type of technological disaster unknown in the 18th century. Historians of technology have long pointed out the importance of indignation over early railroad tragedies in developing the first complex control systems in American business, not to mention safety hardware like signals and air brakes. But there is an equally interesting side to the intensification of transportation by the railroad, the rise of automobile transport. Casualties from car accidents occur as a steady series of small disasters, not the few but great wrecks involving trains and steamships. The automobile invited chronic catastrophes. Indignation built more slowly. The growing capacity of the nation's railroad network had an unforeseen consequence that few scholars have noted. Chaos in the horse-drawn city. Nearly every passenger journey or freight shipment began and ended with a horse-drawn vehicle or a horse, at least until cable cars and electric trolleys spread late in the century. Even the physical size of horses increased throughout the 19th century to move the heavier loads and serve the larger populations of European and American cities. By the 1880s, massive Percherons were a familiar sight on American streets. Teamstering already was a crucial trade, and the number of horses for every teamster was growing. Local delivery by horse could cost nearly as much as hundreds of miles by rail. Today's Budweiser Clydesdales, a magnificent public relations asset, are the heritage of yesterday's logistical nightmares. Herds of horses multiplied. Even after cable and electric power had begun to replace horse traction for streetcars, horses were everywhere. The Fiss, Dorr, and Carroll Horse Auction Mart on East 24th Street in New York drew up to 1,000 buyers and boasted its own 7-story, block-long stable. New York City's horses alone produced over 300 million pounds of manure annually. Stables accumulated tens of thousands of cubic feet for months at a time. In fact, as we have seen, one imported pest, the English sparrow, thrived on the bounty of grain in horse droppings. Repeated horse epidemics, technically epizootics, paralyzed commerce and interfered with firefighting. Despite limitation of their workdays to 4 hours, horses died after only a few years of service, usually in the middle of the street, up to 15,000 a year in New York. Dust from powdered horse manure helped spread tuberculosis and tetanus. As railroads grew safer, the horse-drawn city became more dangerous. Less remembered today than the sanitary problems caused by horses were the safety hazards they posed. Horses and horse-drawn vehicles were dangerous, killing more riders, passengers, and pedestrians than is generally appreciated. Horses panicked. In frequent urban traffic snarls, they bit and kicked some who crossed their path. Horse-related accidents were an important part of surgical practice in Victorian England, and no doubt in North America as well. In the 1890s in New York, per capita deaths from wagons and carriage accidents nearly doubled. By the end of the century, they stood at nearly 6 per 100,000 of population. Added to the 5 or so streetcar deaths, the rate of about 110 per million is closer to the rates of motor vehicle deaths in many industrial countries in the 1980s. On the eve of motorization, the urban world was not such a gentle place. The automobile was an answer to disease and danger. In fact, private internal combustion transportation was almost utopian. The congested tenements of the center city spread dirt and disease. Dispersing people into the green suburbs was a favorite theme of city reformers. Progressive mayors supported the extension of horse cars and then trolleys. But at least on city stretches, these had an unpleasant intensity of their own. In 1912, the Los Angeles Record found their air, quote, a pestilence, heavy with disease and the emanations from many bodies. A bishop embraced a stout grandmother. A tender girl touched limbs with a city sport, unquote. And hard-pressed strap hangers objected to allegedly high fares, reckless drivers, and rude conductors. Automobiles may have begun as rich people's toys, but thanks largely to Henry Ford, they soon came to represent independence from the rich. From railroad interests, traction, streetcar companies, center city landlords. By the 1950s and the 1960s, the automotive industry had come to represent big business at its most urgent, but motorization won because it rallied so many small businesses. Diffuse interests were its political strength. Motoring did not benefit only car manufacturers and petroleum producers and refiners. It enriched tens of thousands of small businesses, trucking companies, suburban developers, construction contractors, dealers and parts retailers, service station operators. Of course, as Clay McShane and other urban historians before him have documented, road improvement was not really populist or uniformly popular. It did change the nature of the street, but to the disadvantage of residents. The roadway ceased to be a gathering place and became a thoroughfare. Many neighborhoods resisted asphalt paving, and children even stoned passing cars. Still, motoring showed the political advantages of spreading benefits to many small and medium-sized interests. In spite of clear damage to urban greenery and space, using roads to help disperse people in private suburban houses remained not just a popular but a politically correct idea for a long time, and not only in America. Franklin D. Roosevelt thought that spreading population would lower the cost of government and directly reduce the expense of urban services. One radical planner, Carol Aronovich, wrote in 1932, quote, "Let the old cities perish so that we may have great and beautiful cities," unquote. Aronovich called for, quote, "a thorough emancipation of the suburban communities from the metropolis," unquote, that was threatening to, quote, "suck their very physical existence into the body politic of decayed and corrupted political organization," unquote. More than 60 years later, these same towns, now aging demographically and economically, are beginning to make common cause with the old central cities against the flight of businesses and residents to the sprawling outer suburbs. At virtually the same time, a school of Soviet planners called the disurbanists were dreaming of dispersing their own overcrowded urban masses into new settlements amid the fields and forests by building new road networks. A distinguished visitor, the French architect Le Corbusier, summed up the mood in his book La Ville Radieuse, 1930. People were encouraged to entertain an idle dream. The cities will be part of the country. I shall live 30 miles away from my office under a pine tree. My secretary will live 30 miles away from it, too, in the other direction, under another pine tree. We shall both have our own car. We shall use up tires, wear out road surfaces and gears, consume oil and gasoline, all of which will necessitate a great deal of work, enough for all. It is almost as though post-war American suburbia was the realized fantasy of Soviet planners. Or, more accurately, the victory of motorization was an unintended consequence of an international decentralizing mood. As Kenneth Jackson has pointed out, even the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists embraced dispersion of cities in a 1951 special issue, Defense Through Decentralization. It promoted satellite cities and low-density suburbs in which former urbanites could be housed more safely for the duration of the Cold War. Automobiles and road systems promoted an old technological utopia, the community of private villas. Automobiles also have an immense advantage over railroads and trolleys. They make it possible to go directly from one outlying point to another. America never had an integrated national or even regional transportation network as European countries did. Its trains and even some of its urban transport systems were run by competing corporations. Nostalgic admirers of railroad transportation forget how many trips required completing two sides of a triangle, sometimes with hours of waiting between them. K. H. Schaefer and Elliot Sklar, transportation analysts, exposed these shortcomings trenchantly in Access for All, a trip of 14 miles from the small town of New Washington, Ohio, to its county seat could take all day by rail, even when train travel was at its peak. And New Washington's two depots were a half mile apart. Usually motorization bought space rather than time. Ivan Illich wrote in 1974, quote, "The typical American spends over 1,600 hours a year, or 30 hours a week, or 4 hours a day, including Sundays, in his car. This includes the time spent behind the wheel, moving or stopped, the hours of work needed to pay for it, and for gasoline, tires, tolls, insurance, fines, and taxes. For this American, it takes 1,600 hours to cover a year total of 6,000 miles, 4 miles per hour. This is just as fast as a pedestrian and slower than a bicycle," unquote. In fact, the greatest surprise of motoring was the speed at which traffic clogged the roads, including freeways and other limited access highways built to relieve congestion. When the Washington Beltway was dedicated in 1964, the governor of Maryland, who cut the ribbon on its last segment, called it a road of opportunity. The Federal Highway Administrator compared it to a wedding ring. The Washington Post declared that, quote, "The stenographer in Suitland will be able to get to the Pentagon without finding the day ruined almost before it begins," unquote. 22 years later, another Post correspondent reported, quote, "The dream turned to nightmare. The great belt tightened to the point where right now it resembles nothing less than a noose around the communal neck. We could die on the beltway and rot until vultures pick clean our bones," unquote. London's counterpart, the M25, had already exceeded its projected traffic for the year 2001 by the late 1980s, only 3 years after completion. Surprisingly, even states like Kentucky, Missouri, Nebraska, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas classify more than half their interstate highway mileage as congested. And mature suburbs of large cities have become so traffic-choked that the American Automobile Association itself has moved its headquarters from Fairfax County, Virginia, to Florida. There are social reasons for this recongestion. Not just two commuter families, but the multiple motorized errands that suburban living demands. Saturday afternoons may be the most crowded times of all. Traffic engineers, applied mathematicians, and economists have also discovered that expanding old routes and adding new ones may actually increase travel time. An enlarged bridge will redirect traffic that had been taking a longer route around it, but unless it is substantially larger, it will be just as slow. New highways also may increase total travel time for all travelers when they draw traffic from alternative rail systems. And the ultimate recongesting effect is called Brace's Paradox, in honor of a pioneering investigator of the subject. Where each of two congested routes has a bottleneck, adding what appears to be a shortcut between them may actually increase travel time for everyone. The reason? The new direct road actually funnels traffic through both the old bottlenecks. Thanks to quirks of driver psychology, even common operations like merging traffic can produce equally counterproductive results. Because motorists tend to close up spaces to discourage entering cars from cutting in front of them, especially when these attempt to enter from other roads, mysterious traffic jams can appear a mile or more from the actual merge. Because spaces are tight, a driver decelerating slightly at the head of a clump can unwittingly induce one following motorist after another to brake a bit harder. And when congestion reaches a certain maximum roadway capacity, the flow of cars falls so sharply that traffic engineers recognize, but still can't fully explain, a breakdown. What appears rational to an individual driver becomes irrational for the motoring population and for society. Recongesting turns out to be a form of recomplicating, of creating a machine of parts coupled in poorly understood ways. What is interesting technologically about this new congestion is its unexpectedly positive side. It has helped make driving safer than anyone thought it would ever be. Congestion may be a chronic negative side effect of mobility, but safety is a positive outcome of congestion. There is a school of thought that denies that driving or anything else can ever be made safer. This is called risk homeostasis. The phrase means simply that people unconsciously seek a certain level of hazard. They compensate for dangerous conditions by driving more cautiously and offset safety measures by taking more risks. The geographer John G.U. Adams looked into the accident rate of England's adventure playgrounds, loosely supervised assortments of high wooden ladders and platforms that offer opportunities to test skills appropriate to chimpanzees. They are visibly more dangerous than fixed equipment playgrounds with their smooth surfaces and rubberized matting. Yet insurance companies quote lower liability rates for the adventure playgrounds, and the secretary of the National Playing Fields Association has written that, quote, the accident rate is lower than in orthodox playgrounds, since hooliganism, which results from boredom, is absent, unquote. Adams and others, mainly social scientists, have argued conversely that seatbelts, by making drivers feel more secure, actually cause more pedestrian casualties even as they reduce motorist injuries. Few traffic engineers accept risk homeostasis as a principle, or the seatbelt as an instance of it. In fact, as Leonard Evans, a physicist and safety researcher, argues, some safety measures save more lives than we might have predicted, but others may actually increase casualties. The 55-mile-per-hour speed limit reduced deaths more than anyone had expected. Seatbelts met expectations. Studded tires, improved acceleration, and anti-lock braking systems, ABS, have a moderate benefit, though there is some evidence that ABS-equipped drivers may have as many crashes as those not similarly equipped, or perhaps even more. New traffic signals seem to have a neutral effect. So do strict inspections. And surprisingly, zebra stripes and flashing lights at crossings actually increase pedestrian injuries significantly. That does not mean they are useless. As another leading traffic specialist, Frank Haight, has put it, the benefit of some safety measures is fair access rather than safety. They give pedestrians not absolute protection from reckless motorists, but the welcome ability to cross roads that would otherwise be almost impassable. Changing any single piece of hardware or any law may or may not have the desired effect. It isn't only safer equipment, then, that has brought down the rate of deaths per million passenger miles. In fact, cause and effect might be reversed. Only when drivers start giving up speed and price to protection do manufacturers start selling safer cars. And that seems to depend on the amount of driving. the British mathematician and traffic engineer R.J. Smeed had that most remarkable gift, the ability to point out an obvious pattern that others had missed. In 1949, Smeed began to plot the relationship between fatalities per vehicle and vehicles per capita. What he found then, and what he and others have noticed ever since, is that more driving makes fatal accidents less likely per mile driven. In the late 1960s, for example, the nations with the highest fatality rates were developing countries with few private automobiles per capita. Even today, within Europe, the riskiest countries are those on the periphery, like Portugal, where automobile ownership is still 20 years or more behind England or Germany. John Adams, while dissenting from Smeed's conclusions about the reasons for greater safety, found that later data supported Smeed's original 1949 paper. Smeed's observations point to a very complex process, a set of technological, legal, and social changes that more general driving brings. Countries with few roads, wide open spaces, and few vehicles may be dangerous to motorists' health. A colleague once recalled from her childhood in Iran that on long stretches of country road, chauffeurs raced toward each other in the center, playing a local variation of chicken. Visibility was excellent, but there were no lane-dividing stripes. One driver nearly always turned off. The point was to wait long enough to maintain one's honor. What in the United States are adolescent rights may elsewhere be the serious contests of middle-aged men. Early motorization's mix of human, animal, and motor power can be equally fatal. In India in the early 1980s, there were 75 road deaths a day, half as many as in the United States, which had 40 times as many vehicles. 20 times more people were killed in accidents than in floods. In 1989, more than 1,000 died on the Grand Trunk Road from New Delhi to Calcutta alone. Uniquely Indian or Third World? Not at all. Early in the century, New York also had a mix of animal-drawn vehicles, automobiles, streetcars, bicycles, and pedestrians, and saw casualties double during the earliest driving boom. Congestion leads to demands for limited access roads that in turn promote safer high-speed driving. U.S. national statistics also suggest that the most dangerous roads are straight two-lane desert highways, with the worst being the notorious U.S. 66 near Gallup, New Mexico. One study of motor vehicle crash mortality found a hundredfold variation. In Esmeralda County, Nevada, the death rate was 558 per 100,000, while in Manhattan, it was 2.5. In hilly country with old roads and many new drivers, the results are similar. Whereas the United States had 248 deaths per million vehicles in 1989, Britain 248, and the Netherlands 236, Portugal had 1,163. The Portuguese-based writer Robert D. Kaplan has written of drivers on the twisting and crumbling Sintra-Lisbon Highway, quote, "Instead of going slow, they race along, passing on curves at night with the ease and tranquility of a blind person reading Braille," unquote. Yet these same people are impeccably courteous pedestrians and have passed stiff written tests requiring a 3-month course. The gentle Malaysians, mostly teetotaling Muslims, also reflect the spirit of early motorization. "Malaysian drivers love to pass on blind curves or approaching hills," wrote one visiting American. "They routinely ride up on each other's tails, going 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, then impertinently flash their headlights." The traffic congestion of highly motorized countries poses a chronic rather than an acute health menace. Road safety statistics do not reflect the health consequences of vehicle emissions. A car that covers 10 miles in 30 minutes of rush hour crawl produces 3.5 times the hydrocarbons of one that takes 11 minutes at off-peak hours. Idling engines produce 300 times as much carbon monoxide as those running freely. While automotive emissions were reduced by 76% to 96% from 1967 to 1990, the number of cities with hazardous ground-level ozone increased to over 100 by the late 1980s. Estimates of the health and agricultural damage done by carbon monoxide and smog range from $5 billion to $16 billion per year. All of these are serious chronic consequences, but they don't alter the fact that riding in a motor vehicle has become far safer. There is an unexpected discipline in the apparently more dangerous congested road. Interstates and other limited access highways would not be feasible without a minimum traffic volume. Density forces slower and more uniform speeds. It also makes possible greater police supervision, better rescue services, and easier access to emergency treatment facilities. The safest part of the New Jersey Turnpike is the crowded metropolitan portion north of New Brunswick. The more rural South Jersey section has twice its accident rate. And much of the reason is that congestion compels vigilance. The chairman of the Turnpike Authority explained, quote, "In the north, there is so much going on, you're pumping adrenaline just to stay on top of it. We're keeping you alert up here. Down there, you're dozing," unquote. In fact, as Albert O. Hirschman has pointed out, proper driving is actually easier in the city than in the country. "The city traffic requires greater technical mastery, but this increase in the difficulty of driving is outweighed by the fact that intense traffic helps the driver in the task of focusing his attention." In spite of countless incidents of violence on the highway, in spite of all our experiences to the contrary, mature motorization seems to engender, relatively, more courteous and disciplined behavior, collective learning, in Leonard Evans' phrase, or as the Washington Post's Malcolm Gladwell puts it, quote, "driving under the influence of society," unquote. A spokesman from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety reports that while safety-related advertising once appeared to harm sales by substituting fear for fantasy, quote, "safety is only second to quality and well ahead of price in the consumer's mind," unquote. We are far from the free spirits of early motoring, of Booth Tarkington's George Amberson Miniver, of Kenneth Graham's Mr. Toad, quote, "the terror, the traffic queller, the lord of the lone trail, before whom all must give way or be smitten into nothingness and everlasting night," unquote. Or, as the columnist Richard Cohen has written, quote, "Jay Gatsby never dreamed of gridlock," unquote. Conservation of catastrophe? Marine navigation and motoring alike seem to argue for optimism, for the idea that intensification can be tamed, in fact that disasters are self-correcting. Society learns. Progress, that long-despised concept, comes in by the back door. The point is not that disasters continue, but that on balance, and by most measures, people continue to be better off. Unfortunately, for technological optimism, things are not quite so simple. The Titanic's sinking has been moralized so much that we have to remember the incident would have turned out much differently had her plates not fractured. No one had tested, and possibly no one could have tested, metal for the kind of brittle fracture her hull experienced. Even if the crew had been able to evacuate every passenger safely, the loss of the ship would have been one of the greatest material disasters of peacetime marine history. The disturbing fact about the accident is that we can never be completely confident of the behavior of any new material as part of a complex system. Splinters from fiber optic cables, to take just one case, can pose serious health risks for telephone workers, and especially for self-taught laypeople, who have to cut and splice them. Yet it is rare to see this problem mentioned in most discussions of networking. Software adds another dimension to complexity. We have seen in Chapter 9 how high the risk of fatal bugs in life-critical systems can be. Malfunction in software control of processes is also less likely to produce the warning signals familiar in the mechanical world. Heat, noise, color change, vibration. A system crash may be much more sudden. It is harder to achieve what engineers call graceful degradation. The historian of science, Michael S. Mahoney, has observed that computers do not eliminate artisans, but reintroduce them in the new guise of programmers. Recomplication has made software so bulky that only teams of programmers can write it. Yet talented programmers are individualists who do not usually work efficiently as part of a team. This affects not only operating systems and application software for desktop computers, but the code that runs everything from aircraft navigation to automotive fuel injection and medical equipment. As John Shore, a software engineer, has pointed out, vigilance works well for mechanical systems. High-rise elevators need constant maintenance, but they rarely injure people. Software requires maintenance too, but this makes it less rather than more reliable. Every feature that is added and every bug that is fixed adds the possibility of some new and unexpected interaction between parts of the program. A small change to solve a minor problem may create a larger one. The technical writer Lauren Wiener has noted that the repeated paralysis of local and regional telephone systems in 1991 resulted from only a few changed lines in the millions of lines of code that drove call routing computers. A meaningful test of the revisions would have taken 13 weeks. Catastrophic risk will stay with us because more, rather than less, of life is likely to depend on complex software. Intelligent Vehicle Highway Systems, IVHS, may someday squeeze more capacity out of existing limited access roads. Individual vehicles under electronic control would join formations called platoons. These convoys could be spaced more tightly than today's normal traffic, and they could control some of our daily highway nightmares, such as the tailgater, the lane jumper, and the sleepless trucker. But if software or communication or even a lead vehicle's tire failed, the results could be catastrophic. If we add the dependence of government, banking, and commerce on global electronic networks that in turn depend on software, a revival of catastrophic errors cannot be ruled out. And the critics of IVHS insist that electronically controlled roads will soon be recongested anyway. Even more serious than hidden risk may be displaced risk. The safety of one technology has a way of creating danger in another. Our current successes may be preparing us for failures where we least expect them. We have seen how good hygiene left the well-scrubbed children of the middle and upper classes more susceptible to polio than the dirty kids of the poor. We have also noted the suggestion of Mirko D. Gromek that success in suppressing bacterial infection indirectly promoted the rise of AIDS and other new viral infections by leaving a niche for virulent pathogens. If hidden risk is the concern of the liberal, distrustful of corporate assurances of safety through technology, displaced risk is the objection of the conservative to regulation. And conservative skepticism is directed less often at technologies themselves than at attempts to limit, regulate, or impose them. Requiring parents to place their infants in paid-for child carrier seats on airlines instead of carrying them on their laps may lead more families to drive instead of fly. Since aircraft are safer than highways, the argument runs, the rule may injure more infants than would have been hurt in the air. Pesticide-free fruit and vegetables at high prices may be more harmful to public health by reducing consumption by the poor than cheap produce with pesticide residues would have been. Taking this line of thought to an extreme, one British researcher has even found that male physicians who quit smoking tend to offset their health gains with higher rates of alcoholism, accidents, and suicide. Not surprisingly, tobacco industry sources supported this study. Like hidden risks, displaced risks appear impossible to rule out of any proposed change. The natural and social worlds interact in too many poorly understood ways. Risk analysts call these unexpected effects type 3 errors. A type 1 error is an unnecessary preventive step, like evacuating a coastline when storm warnings turn out to be a false alarm, or delaying the approval of a life-saving drug. A type 2 error is a decidedly harmful action, like releasing a drug that turns out to have lethal side effects. When strict directives on meat radiation after the Chernobyl meltdown of 1986 destroyed the lap reindeer meat economy, as a recent report of the Royal Society pointed out, the unexpectedness of the result made it a type 3 rather than a type 1 error. Many market-oriented risk analysts, like Aaron Wildowski, urge resilience and gradual responses to unforeseen consequences as they occur, rather than attempts to calculate and balance all possible results. The report of the Royal Society points to clearly organized schools of anticipationism and resilientism. Resilience often turns out to be an excellent policy, provided the phenomena cooperate and appear distinctly and gradually on the horizon. In the real world, few trends emerge without ambiguity, beyond a reasonable doubt, before precious time is lost. It is now more than 150 years since the eccentric French utopian socialist Charles Fourier predicted that the increasing cultivation of the Earth would bring about higher temperatures and eventually a melting of the polar ice cap. While Fourier's scientific credentials were dubious, he thought the northern seas would become a sort of lemonade and humanity would move about on anti-lions and get their fish from anti-sharks, he was on to something. In fact, at about the same time, another Frenchman, coincidentally also named Fourier, the physicist Jean-Baptiste, discovered that the Earth's atmosphere maintains the planet's warmth by trapping heat. As early as 100 years ago, the Swedish geochemist Svante Arrhenius speculated on a possible increase of up to 6 degrees centigrade in air temperature if industrial carbon dioxide emissions continued to grow. Yet even now, the science we need most gives us not the precision we want, but a set of possible tempos and consequences. We want numbers, but instead our best models give us ranges. We want a truth that will apply to the whole globe, or at least to our own continent, and face the likelihood of patchy local change. We want an idealized 18th-century celestial mechanics to rule our world, but we find only probabilistic models. We can't even count on conditions continuing to drift slowly. As Stephen Jay Gould and others have often reminded us, steep rather than gradual natural change is the norm, and it is extremely hard to predict the future state of a complex system even without the added imponderables of human culture and behavior. Well before climate became an issue, human culture, including technology, set off bizarre chains of cause and effect. The fashion for feathers and entire dead birds on women's hats in the late 19th century devastated whole species, but it also drew women and men into bird preservation movements that outlived the fad. The early automobile spread its own nemesis, the puncture weed with its tire-killing spiked seed pods. Decades after safer and puncture-resistant tubeless tires appeared, this technology unexpectedly abetted another pest, the Asian tiger mosquito, a vector for dengue fever, which traveled the Pacific in recycled tires and now enjoys an extended breeding season in water that collects in tire dumps. We have already seen how cleaning up European harbors probably helped spread tenacious zebra mussels to North America. Yet motorization also helped reduce the population of European sparrows. Anyone correctly predicting these sequences well in advance would have seemed a crank or an alarmist. In fact, most of the greatest changes of the 20th century simply did not occur to the 19th century imagination. Air war and weapons of mass destruction were outstanding exceptions, and even these were logical extensions of pre-1900 sieges and bombardments. Otherwise, the human ability to envision something truly new, good or bad, is surprisingly limited. Late 20th century personal computers are radically different, not just from 19th century analytical engines and mechanical calculators, but even from those far slower behemoths, the post-war data processors of the von Neumann era. High European mortality in tropical Asia and Africa did not prepare the Western mind for the emergence of AIDS and other new viruses, nor for the influenza epidemic of 1918. Extrapolation doesn't work because neither nature nor human society is guaranteed to act reasonably. Some things, like computer processor power and data storage, get better and cheaper more quickly than the optimists expected. On the other hand, the tasks that they are supposed to perform, like machine translation, turn out to be more difficult than most people had thought. What is almost a constant, though, is that the real benefits usually are not the ones that we expected, and the real perils are not those we feared. What prevail are sets of loosely calculable factors and ranges of outcomes, with no accepted procedure for choosing among them. And since we have seen that it is impossible to rid any computer models of bugs, we have no assurance that reality will not be well beyond our projected range in either direction. Instead of the malice of the isolated object, we face ever more complicated possible linkages among systems of objects. It is impossible, then, to prove that large-scale disasters will not reassert themselves in North America and the rest of the developed world, that we will not intensify not only our chronic problems, but our acute ones. William H. McNeill has a telling phrase for this possibility, the conservation of catastrophe. Just as engineers will continue to explore the bounds of a safe bridge design, test pilots will push the envelope, regional planners will overrate the capacity of roads to evacuate a hurricane zone, and engineers will disregard all they have learned about O-rings. We can even find analogies in the realm of finance. The New Deal's precautions against the bank failures of the Depression created institutions that helped promote the wave of savings and loan bankruptcies of the 1980s. International electronic networks for communication and commerce make new kinds of disasters possible, as localized malfunctions now have unprecedented opportunities for spreading. If the postal carriers of one city start hoarding or discarding mail, it is a major problem, but no immediate threat to the system's integrity. If a network node were to go wrong in some unforeseen way, worldwide systems could fail before the cause was even identified. The real question is not whether new disasters will occur. Of course they will. It is whether we gain or lose ground as a result. It is whether our apparent success is part of a long-term and irreversible improvement in the human condition, or a deceptive respite in a grim and open-minded Malthusian pressure of human numbers and demands against natural limits. It is whether revenge effects are getting worse or milder. I think, but cannot prove, that in the long run they are going to be good for us. And I would like to suggest why. Retreating from intensity. Revenge effects reached their peak in the 100 years between the 1860s and the 1960s, during the very acme of technological optimism. Clobbering nature into submission united North Americans and Europeans, communists and Republicans. Explosives, heavy machinery, agriculture, and transportation seemed at last to be fulfilling the injunction of Genesis 1:28 to, quote, fill the earth and subdue it, unquote. Soviet citizens named their children for Henry Ford and his tractors. Contemporaries thought they were living at the beginning of an era of open-ended change, but it is also clear that few of them reckoned with the tendency of nature to strike back. Although, as the historian Douglas Weiner has documented, Friedrich Engels himself wrote of how nature avenges humanity against exploitation, the Eastern Bloc kept subjugating its part of the planet until the bitter end. The real meaning of communism's collapse had less to do, in fact, with collectivism than with a fixation on intensity that continued through the Gorbachev years. Officially, the regime campaigned to conserve materials, but it also set output goals by weight, not performance. Industrial quotas, meted out in metric tons, were filled with heavy stuff, sometimes incredibly sturdy, more often simply bad. The alleged Soviet boast of producing the world's largest microchips may be apocryphal, but Marshall I. Goldman, an economist who visited the USSR often, noticed an exceptional proportion of office typewriters with unnecessary extra-long carriages. The Soviet fixation on goals by gross weight and volume was only an extreme case of the pathology of intensity, the single-minded overextension of a good thing. We should keep in mind that the West went through even more serious crises of intensification. Potatoes, a great benefit for the European popular diet, were genetically vulnerable when grown from a single strain and used as a primary source of nutrition by the very poor. Yet terrible as the Irish potato famine of the 1840s was, nothing like it has recurred. The crash of the French raw silk industry in the 1850s, so important for Louis Pasteur's career, also showed how dangerous it could be for so many families to link their economic fate to a single organism. It is curious how many resource-rich nations and regions have faltered because they relied too strongly on exploiting only one or two sources of natural wealth. The Mississippi Delta, the deserted mining towns of the Rockies, and the desolate coal patches of the Pennsylvania anthracite country all have their counterparts overseas. Sicily, the Ukraine, and Argentina as former world breadbaskets, Romania and Azerbaijan as fabled energy reserves, Zaire and Siberia as gold vaults, the Ruhr as ironworks. The nature of the resource does not seem to matter, nor do colonialism or foreign rule, though absentee ownership may. It was wealth that became an enemy of a vital diversity. On the other side, resource-poor islands and formerly isolated regions like Switzerland, Japan, Taiwan, and Singapore have become the 20th century's economic stars. Of course, it is too optimistic to say that we have overcome the perils of intensity. We have already seen how rationalized forestry in England and Scotland has helped turn the familiar ground squirrel of North America into a significant woodland pest. The science writer Matt Ridley has described how even in Tory England, state-promoted conversion of unproductive downland to wheat fields and ancient forests to conifer plantations had endangered butterflies and other native wildlife and plants. In Spain and Portugal, the ancient dehesa of mixed cork oak and holm oak in a setting of grain and grasslands have also been threatened by clearance for euro-subsidized crops. Elsewhere, clear-cut forestry and overfishing continue. The greatest risk of any new natural technology, especially a genetic one, is not a superpest. It is an apparently harmless organism or chemical that begins as a stunning success and displaces alternatives in the marketplace. Making anything so hardy and productive is like announcing a huge prize for the first naturally selected pests and parasites. Sooner or later, there will be a big winner. All this hardly means that science or technology has over-intensified life or that traditional agriculture was always environmentally benign. In the Mediterranean and elsewhere, pre-industrial agriculture could devastate as well as foster diversity. It is hard to imagine any biologically engineered organism as catastrophic in the wild as the otherwise useful and endearing goat. And technologies can follow a number of alternative paths depending on the assumptions and interests of those who develop and support them. Technologies can help preserve old genetic resources, evaluate new crops, reduce the quantity of pesticide and herbicide applications, consume less water. In other words, they can diversify and de-intensify. This implies a new balance between public and market-driven research, since, as the geneticist Richard C. Lewontin and others have shown, commercial research necessarily neglects natural, non-patentable varieties of organisms that would be in the public domain after the first sale. In agriculture, the retreat from intensity means foregoing applications of heavy fertilizer in favor of planting complementary crops in the same fields, increasing both productivity and resilience. In medicine, the retreat from intensity demands a shift away from the heavy reliance on a handful of antibiotics. In business computing, it implies a heavy dose of skepticism about the functional value of more powerful new releases of both hardware and software. It also suggests doubts as to whether higher workloads and longer days always yield more profit. Sometimes it even calls for deliberately slowing or interrupting the pace of work. In sports, it provokes a harder look at whether stiffer and more powerful equipment necessarily makes for a better game. The retreat from intensification does not necessarily require giving it up. It does mean subjecting it to much greater scrutiny. It isn't enough, of course, to modify intensity. Reducing revenge effects demands substituting brains for stuff. And the record of human ingenuity in making brain power do the work of energy and raw materials is impressive. Balloon frame houses, the invention of anonymous carpenters on the nearly treeless prairies of the 19th century American Midwest, became famous for their durability as well as their economy. In our own time, the cheapest electronic computers available today from any discount store can calculate many times faster than the room and building size arrays of relays and vacuum tubes of the industry's pioneer days. Steel is lighter and stronger, yet certain plastics are lighter and stronger than steel. Automobiles now weigh less and use less gasoline per mile. A CD weighs a fraction of an LP, and a CD player is lighter and more compact than a conventional turntable. New mathematical algorithms allow the same information to be stored on smaller disks, or more information on the same size disk. The engineer Robert Herman, the technology analyst Jesse H. Aucebel, and their associates argue that technological change exerts powerful forces both for increasing and for reducing the amount of energy and other resources used. Electronic storage can reduce the consumption of paper, but as we have seen, it can also multiply it. Lighter goods may heighten rather than diminish the need for materials if they are marketed or treated as throwaways rather than durables. Thick, returnable glass bottles may, for example, demand less intense use of energy and other resources than even recyclable aluminum. In fact, as Herman and Aucibel have suggested, lighter and more efficient automobiles promote resource-consuming, if dispersed, suburban living, and thus materialization. Nuclear power generation begins with low-weight raw materials, but ends with vast contaminated structures that probably can never be reused. What appears to be a technological question, how much of anything we really need, is in the end a social one. It is the size and appearance of a yard or a lawn or a house, the taste for, or repudiation of, meat and so forth. Often what is most crucial and most uncertain is not invention and discovery, but taste and preference. The open question, raised during the upheavals of the 1970s and then forgotten during the boom of the 1980s, is whether cultural change can lead to new preferences that will in turn relieve humanity's pressure on the Earth's resources. Human culture, not some inherent will of the machine, has created most revenge effects. Without the taste for silk, there would have been no gypsy moths in North America. Without the preference for detached housing, there would still be congestion, perhaps, but more economical congestion. Without the love of oceanside living, shore erosion, yes, but no social disruption. Even more promising than diversification and dematerialization is an attitude that has not yet found its rightful name. It is the substitution of cunning for the frontal attack, and it is not new. It began with immunization against smallpox, as we have seen, a folk practice long before Edward Jenner introduced it to medicine, and continued with the vaccines of the late 19th and 20th centuries. Finesse means abandoning frontal attacks for solutions that rely on the same kind of latent properties that led to revenge effects in the first place. Sometimes it means ceasing to suppress a symptom. In medicine, finesse suggests closer attention to the evolutionary background of human health and illness, to the positive part that fever plays, for example, in fighting infection. At other times, finesse means living with and even domesticating a problem organism. As we have seen, researchers like Stanley Falco and Paul Ewald have suggested a kind of evolutionary compromise with what are now lethal bacteria and viruses, turning them into common but harmless companions. In the office, finesse means producing more by taking more frequent breaks and conveying more information by, for example, limiting rather than multiplying color schemes. In construction, finesse means allowing skyscrapers to sway slightly in the wind instead of bracing them to resist it. On the road, finesse means a calmer approach to driving, improving the speed and economy of all drivers by slowing them down at times when impulse would prompt accelerating. It can mean moving more traffic by metering access to some roads and even closing off others. Some German analysts have written of the softening, Besänftigung, of traffic. Diversification, dematerialization, and finesse are far from a rejection of science. To the contrary, it is science that points us away from crude reductionism and counterproductive brute force toward technologies that improve human life. But the improvement has a cost. As the Red Queen said in Through the Looking Glass, we are no longer in the slow sort of country, where running gets one somewhere. Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. And in fact, the alternatives to the intensified, revenge-prone modes of earlier technology seem to take nearly all the running we can do. Even the optimistic report of the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology, CAST, makes clear that most of our agricultural research goes to maintenance, that is, to keeping the gains we have made, dealing with deteriorating water quality and increasing costs, and offsetting biological surprises, like the appearance of more virulent pests. The same could probably be said of many medical efforts. Similarly, the power of personal computer hardware seems driven by the need to compensate for the way that more elaborate interfaces and features slow the fundamentals of performance. Technological optimism means, in practice, the ability to recognize bad surprises early enough to do something about them. And that demands constant monitoring of the globe for everything from changes in mean temperatures and particulates to traffic in bacteria and viruses. It also requires a second level of vigilance at increasingly porous national borders against the world exchange of problems. But vigilance does not end there. It is everywhere. It is in the random alertness tests that have replaced the dead man's pedal for train operators. It is in the rituals of computer backup, the legally mandated testing of everything from elevators to home smoke alarms, routine X-ray screening, securing and loading new computer virus definitions. It is in the inspection of arriving travelers for products that might harbor pests. Even our alertness in crossing the street, second nature to urbanites now, was generally unnecessary before the 18th century. Sometimes vigilance is more of a reassuring ritual than a practical precaution, but with any luck, it works. Revenge effects mean, in the end, that we will move ahead, but must always look back, just because reality is indeed gaining on us.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Why Things Bite Back, Technology and the Revenge of Unintended Consequences. Written by Edward Tenner. Narrated by Steve Kramer. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 1996 by Edward Tenner. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.